Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special Mother's Day edition featuring just some of the amazing women who have shared their powerful stories here over the years. If you're ever in Washington, D.C., you have to take some time to experience the Women in Military Service for America Memorial right at the entrance to Arlington National Cemetery. It really captures the depth and the breadth of what women have done in our armed forces. And if you're in Colorado on Memorial Day, you've got to get to the Boulder Boulder. It's one of the largest Memorial Day events in the country, and you can meet one of the veterans who's going to be honored there this year, Lila Morrison. She was a nurse with the 118th Evacuation Hospital in Europe in World War II.
We only took care of emergencies if we received casualties that we thought would live until they got back behind in a station or general hospital. We sent them back. But if we thought they wouldn't live long enough to make it back, then we accepted them. Our first tent was a doctor and several Corps boys. Patients went in there first, and he assessed them, divided them if they thought they could go back or if we had. So my tent was right behind him, and that was shock and pre-op. And my job was to bring fellas out of shock. Then if they were going to do surgery, which most of them had to have, I got them ready for surgery. And I had several Corps boys in there with me, helping me. One of the biggest things we did, see, this was back in the 40s, we had no way of preserving whole blood. And that's what all the boys needed. They need whole blood.
Because
if they weren't hemorrhaging, they had been. So this plasma, blood plasma, is what we gave, and that was supposedly at that time the next thing best to whole blood. It was conducted into a powder, and then we had a bottle of sterile water, and we mixed those together and gave them IV as quickly as we could.
And just by the sheer numbers and the reality of what some of these wounds and injuries are, I mean, you're faced with a situation where a good number of these young men who you're trying to help, you know they're not going to make it.
Yes, you did. Unfortunately, that was true.
How hard was that to deal with?
That was hard, very hard, because they were all young. Some of them, I was 22, like I say, and I know some of them were younger than I was. I'm sure they cheated a little on their age if their parents would sign. Oh, some of them never shaved, you know, just real young. But they had a wonderful spirit, every one of them. They were there to win that war. They loved America. They were so thankful to be an American. And even when it meant, and of course, all of them knew any minute could be the last. But none of them ever complained or said, "I'm sorry I came," or any of that.
And you said what your job was. How did that work? You know, I don't want to dwell on gory details or any of that, but so we have a perspective of some of what you saw. Can you give us a sense of what the condition of some of these guys were, why they were in your hospital, and what you guys hoped to do for them?
Well, in order to serve, you had to be in good health.
Well, and what I mean is the nature of the injuries that you saw. I mean, I'm sure you said before nothing could have prepared you for it. You saw guys missing limbs?
Yes, missing limbs. Shot. You know, with as many as we saw, I'd say almost every place. Before we got down on the front, we were with what was called DS, Detached Service, and we worked in those hospitals and took care of, chronically. And many, many of them lost their limbs from frostbite. They would say, well, we were down in this foxhole, and we were there for a week. And it was cold. That was in December. Of course, the foxhole had snow in it, and it would melt. And they'd have to stand there in the water maybe for several days. I remember one saying, my socks were all wet, my feet were so cold, but nobody had a warm pair of socks. So it lasted long enough that they did get frostbites.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd be so down when they lose a leg. They're just so depressed. And you hate to tell them that their leg was gone, or maybe both. But before it was over, when they'd go back behind the lines, they'd be in a ward with others with the same thing. And before you knew it, they'd be having races out in the hall in their wheelchair, all of them laughing and adjusting. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful, wasn't it?
And in this war that claimed millions of lives worldwide and 406,000 American lives, your job was to save lives.
Yes, and it seemed so different. Because we were the only ones there saving lives, or trying to, and everybody else was taking lives.
And you said that your job was to take them from shock to pre-op.
Mm.
You've got to try to keep them alive.
Oh, yeah.
For that time period.
Mm.
And when you say bring them out of shock, how do you do that? What are you doing?
With the blood plasma.
So just their body's in physical shock. They can't function.
No. Many times they're passed out.
Yeah, so you can't talk to them, you can't encourage them in that situation. You're just trying to get life-saving plasma so they can make it till the surgeon can operate.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty intense.
Yes, it is. It doesn't get much more intense than that. And we realized it. We knew that. And that's one reason I was so thankful to be there, because I know we saved lives. Of course, we lost a lot, but we saved some, too. That was encouraging to think that you could be there and have the little bit of knowledge it took to bring them out of that shock and get them on their way to recovery.
Did you ever feel like this was too much for you, that you couldn't handle it anymore?
No, I didn't. See, I was just there a year. Maybe if I'd have been there 3 years, it would have.
I think a lot of people, if they were there 3 days.
Well, that's true, but nursing school prepares you for that. And I think my background, being in the small town and being the bottom of 7 children, it helped me a lot.
Toughened you up a little bit?
Yes, I think so.
And some people are under the mistaken impression that if you are operating a hospital, even a field hospital, an evacuation hospital like you had, that you're somehow safe, that the enemy's not going to shoot you. I think you learned otherwise, didn't you?
Yes, you did. On all of our tents, we had a big Red Cross, great big one. You could see that from the air. But as we got further down into France and Germany and some of those smaller countries, we were never bombed. We had what they call Bed Check Charlie. You've heard of that?
Every night, right?
Mm-hmm. They'd fly over to see what we were doing. We were under complete blackout, which was a little tougher because you had to go outside the tent in a flip. You're there, you know.
Yeah.
Pull the curtain back. You tried to hurry because they told us how many feet up you could see that little light and to be very careful.
And so if they saw the light, Bed Check Charlie, this German bomber, knows where to drop his bomb.
Yes, that's right. And we saw mostly the Air Force with the Silver Star.
Uh-huh.
Our U.S., what a good feeling that was. You'd see many of them, you know, big noise flying over.
I don't want to be melodramatic here, but living with this every day, I mean, from the severe weather, and you're in a tent during the Battle of the Bulge, and you can't take a shower, you can't stay warm. I know you're surrounded by people who are worse off than you are because you're treating them every day. But, I mean, you're just confronted with death on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Did you consider the possibility that you might die over there?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. Because I knew some of the hospitals had been bombed. I don't know, mistake or what, but in a situation like that, it's easy to make a mistake. But, like I said, we were never bombed.
And tell me if this is true. Brad Hoops, who interviewed you here in northern Colorado, shared a little bit of your story with me. He told me that you were ready to die yourself.
I was.
You prayed that if there were nurses that were going to die, let it be you and not those who had a husband and the children.
I did, because I was young and single, and my siblings were all grown and on their own. And see, my mother and dad were both gone. So I just felt it would be so much easier for somebody like me to lose their life than some of those that had such ties at home. And we had boys, they sort of looked at us like a mother, a sister, aunt. And if we ever had time, they'd show us pictures they'd just gotten. And one that I particularly remembered, showed me a snap of a little boy, 3 years old. And he said, "This is my little boy. I've never seen him." Mm-hmm. And where he lived and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So, and the boys were, their spirit and their outlook was just tremendous. I can't say enough good about them.
That's another World War II Army nurse, Leela Morrison. She would marry a man she met in the service and become a mother to three. We've heard from Army, Navy, Marine Corps already. The Coast Guard had women serving in the spars in World War II. But for decades, the work of pioneering female pilots in the war was kept classified. That's no longer the case. And when the WASPs, Women Air Force Service Pilots, were recognized with the Congressional Gold Medal in 2009, it allowed many more to learn about the courageous service of female pilots like Deanie Parrish.
Actually, what we did was no more than what almost every American did. They did something to help our country stay free. So I feel like that what I did was no more than what Rosie the Riveter did, or the women who drove fire trucks, or anything of that nature. We all did something to help our country stay free. And I think that was the important thing. And what did we do? We first, when we went into training, we had to have at least a private pilot's license to even apply to go into Army Air Force training. Now, my husband, who was also an Army Air Force pilot, when he started training, same training that I got, he had never been in an airplane. But things were different then. And for girls, we had to have a license before we could go into training. But all the training, well, the first two classes trained in Houston, but there was not adequate facilities there, so they moved it to Avenger Field out in Sweetwater in West Texas. And we went into training, and I trained there for 7 months. It was an Army Air Force. We had civilian instructors, but all we had 40 Army Air Force officers who were over the entire base. And when we got to Sweetwater, at that time, girls dressed up all the time. We wore high heels. We wore white gloves. We wore hats, you know. And we get to Sweetwater, and we were from all over the country. And we stayed in the only big hotel there, which was maybe four stories. But anyway, the next morning, we were all dressed up in our finest because we were going out to Avenger Field to meet Jacqueline Cochran and all of our instructors. So as we came downstairs and went outside, they said our transportation was there. There were three cow trailers lined up, and that's what our transportation was for the next 7 months. We got out to the airbase, and Miss Cochran was there and spoke to all of us. There were about 100 in my class to begin with. And I'll never forget what she said to us. Because, as I say, it was a different time, a different feeling. But she said to us, "You may be living in a man's world, and you may be flying a man's airplane. But when you get out of that airplane, I want you to remember, you're a lady. And I want you to look like a lady, and I want you to act like a lady. And don't you forget it." So I never forgot. But then we were assigned our bays. We had six girls. We slept on Army cots in each bay. And we trained there for 7 months, the same training that any Army Air Force pilot received. At the end of that 7 months, over half my class had washed out. But the ones of us who were left, we graduated. And then we were assigned to 120 different air bases all over America. For me, I was sent first to Greenville, Mississippi, and as an engineering test pilot. If an aircraft had cracked up and had to have a new wing or anything major repair, it had to be flight tested before the instructors and cadets could fly in it again. And that was my job. But I was there about 2 months, and the operations officer said he wanted to check me out on twin engine aircraft. And about a week after that, I got orders to report down to Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. And when I went there, it was to go through B-26 Martin Marauder training to train gunners.
Well, I got to ask you here, Deanie. First, you say that you have to test these aircraft before the men can fly them. It makes you sound like a little bit like a guinea pig and like you're expendable. So if anything goes wrong, they just lose one of the WASPs and not one of their male pilots.
No.
And then
No, that's not true because we had male engineering test pilots also.
Right, okay.
Because there weren't enough of us to do everything.
So they were guinea pigs of both genders.
Absolutely.
But then they put you in an airplane, the B-26. I'm sure you're familiar with all the awful nicknames that airplane had because of the problems
absolutely.
That it had.
One a day in Tampa Bay.
And you were down there.
I lived 90 miles from Tampa, and my family was not too pleased when I went into B-26 training. But then once I got through, I was retained there as an air-to-air tow target pilot to train gunners for combat. And that's what I did until we were disbanded.
Did you ever, and I have a feeling what your answer is going to be, because you've already echoed what I think is the most important message this show ever gets out, that during this time in our nation's history, everybody was doing something, and everybody was pulling in the same direction to preserve the freedom that we enjoy today. But while you were doing this and training other people to go fight the battles and to go drop the bombs and do everything that they did, was there ever part of you that wished, you know what, I would like to go fly one of those missions like the guys can?
Yes, but we knew that was impossible. When we went in, we were told, of course, that we would not be flying outside the continental United States. But what we did was we took over some of the jobs. Certainly there were not enough of us to take over all the jobs, but we did jobs to relieve male pilots for combat because they, in the early part of 42, we had lost so many combats, especially over North Africa, until there was a tremendous shortage of male pilots, combat pilots. So the jobs that we took over from male pilots so that there could be more combat pilots.
How were you treated by the male pilots? Did you get the sense that they appreciated everything that you did? I'm sure there was one bad apple in the bunch that didn't treat you so well.
Well, I never ran into that bad apple, I'm happy to say. I did my job. I never refused to do anything. And sometimes we were asked to fly, perhaps in weather that maybe the male pilots weren't flying. But it was our duty, and we did it. And I never got anything other than nice treatment. Now, I can't say that for every WASP, because I know that some of them have told me stories of what happened to them. But for me, they were very appreciative of our help.
You know, you mentioned having to fly sometimes in bad weather, and 38 WASPs were killed during World War II as they carried out their different duties across the country. Did you ever have any close calls or some times in the sky where you thought, uh-oh, this might be it for me?
Yes, I got in flying my air-to-air tow target missions. That target was not out far enough sometimes because we would have a B-24 that would come by. We would put down quarter flaps or whatever. They would come by, and they had seven turrets in that B-24, and those green gunners were shooting live ammunition with color-coded bullets at that target, and sometimes the target wasn't far enough behind us. So a couple of times got a few holes in the tail, but with God's help, I got through it. I hope the American people are getting an education about this overlooked history, because it is inspirational history. Because what we did, we didn't compromise the values that we had grown up with just because we were pilots. Honor above everything, patriotism, integrity, service, all of those things that are so important that I just feel like generations to come, they should be allowed to read about that history. And let me tell you, it was both an honor and a privilege to serve this country, and I hope every member of our armed forces today feels the same way. And God bless you for caring.
And God bless Deanie Parrish, who will celebrate Mother's Day with her daughter Nancy, who launched an organization called Wings Across America and a traveling exhibit called Fly Girls to tell the story of WASP pioneers like her mom. Mother and daughter Deanie and Nancy were inducted together into the Women in Aviation Hall of Fame in 2015. There are just a couple more things I want to mention as we bring this special Mother's Day edition to a close. First, if you know any Blue Star moms, women whose children are currently serving in our armed forces. Find a way to reach out to them this Mother's Day and keep them and their children in your prayers. And finally, I have to say a happy Mother's Day to the one-time Army nurse who I'm proud to call my mom. Remember, you can find links to all the full-length original interviews with the women you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you're reminded again today through the stories of some amazing mothers who also happen to be World War II veterans that freedom is not free.